Hello and welcome to another Waytag podcast. I am your host, Corey Jennerjohn, and today I am very excited to be joined by Lisa Van Gamert. Very excited to have her as a guest, and I want to have her give her a little brief introduction about herself. Lisa, take it away.
Hi, Corey. I'm Lisa Van Gamert, and I'm better known in Gifted Land as the Gifted Guru. I started my teaching career teaching third grade, and I've taught everything from third through 12th, including regular education as well as gifted and advanced placement. And now I basically would call myself a teacher's assistant. I create courses and write books and write curriculum and do professional development in order to help teachers who are teaching gifted learners. And I also do a lot of work with gifted learners themselves as well as parents.
Okay. So Lisa, the Gifted Guru, how did that all come about? What is the genesis of the Gifted Guru? I think that's really cool.
Well, it's kind of a funny story. I just recently told this story and I hadn't told it in years. So my name is hard to spell, and it's what I did for love. But I knew that when I started a website, the odds that people were going to be able to type in Lisa Van Gamert were slim and none, and Slim had just left town. And so I needed a name. And at the time, I was the youth and education ambassador for Mensa, and we happened to have a summer social media intern there, this college student who was working on degree marketing. And I was talking to her one day. I can still remember this conversation, just, you know, leaning up against the counter at the reception desk in the office and saying, like, hey, I need this website about gifted ed, and I need it to be easy to find, and can you come up with something? And she came back to my desk later and she said, I think it should be Gifted Guru because alliteration is really good. And that's another G word I can think of that would go. And that's how Gifted Guru was born. And I kind of wish I did not have it now. Like, I would rather have something different. But for anyone who's dealt at all with branding, you know that changing something once it's been existing for over a decade is almost impossible. So what I think of it as, though, is not that I'm the Gifted Guru, but rather that my goal is to help other people be the Gifted Guru, Gifted Gurus, right? And unfortunately, that message doesn't really get passed on. Most people think, like, Lisa is the Gifted Guru. I'm like, no, that's not really what I'm trying to do.
That's interesting. So, you know, you have such a wealth of experience from being a gifted education student yourself to having gifted children of your own and then teaching gifted children and now advocating and, like you said, kind of being like a teacher's aide. Yeah. On the, you know, just kind of the full spectrum coming full circle. How much has gifted education changed in that time, would you say?
Well, it's changed tremendously from the time I began as a student. I can still remember the day I took the Stanford-Binet LM in my elementary school and was placed into gifted services then, which I grew up in Southern California. And in California at that time, the gifted program was called MGM for mentally gifted minors. I think Southern California could not resist the kind of movie connection and so wanted something that sounded like a movie studio. And then it shifted to GATE, which is kind of what it's still called there. Over that time, I've seen it go from where there weren't necessarily equitable identification practices and maybe limited services now, and then an arc of increasing services. And then I would say in the last 5 years, an increasing misunderstanding of what gifted services are and in a misguided desire to have equity, the disassembly of gifted services in lots of very large districts by people who don't understand. And so I think that now what we're seeing is lots of people trying to change the name in order to make it more palatable. And I would really say a downgrading of what we're willing to offer gifted students, a lack of recognition that truly gifted students have different needs, not just cognitively, but also socially and emotionally. And so districts who are running what are essentially not gifted programs, but rather a talent development program, are ignoring the fact that they do have highly gifted students who need additional support in lots of ways.
That's interesting. Has there, do you think, Lisa, has there always been a misunderstanding, like you said? Because, you know, I hear that a lot, of how, you know, school districts nationwide really misunderstand what gifted education really is. Was there a misunderstanding, you know, 10, 15, 20, 25 years ago?
I think the misunderstanding 20 or 25 years ago was the idea that, oh, they'll be fine. Right. Like, in fact, I think there's a podcast about giftedness called They Will Be Fine. I was just a guest on it. And I feel like that's the title of the podcast. They will. Oh, they'll be fine. Right. And I think that was funny. That was a misunderstanding, like that. Oh, gifted services are nice, but they're kind of the chef's kiss of education. They're not the meal. I think that now that has morphed into the misunderstanding that gifted education is elitist. Gifted education is almost racist. And that to me is such a shame, because when people view it that way and they dismantle gifted services, of course, if there are no gifted services, no matter how equitable you are in identification, nobody of any race, any culture, any language background is going to have a gifted program to get into. And so I feel like the misunderstanding has changed, although there is still the sustained idea that giftedness is an artificial construct. And I think that comes from over-egalitarianism, this idea in our society that it's not a good idea to consider that some people may have different abilities than others. We accept it in things like sports and the arts, but we don't accept it in cognitive intelligence.
And I've never understood that. Like, I'll be honest, I've been in athletics my entire life, and I've seen, you know, kids be able to play up a level, you know, if they are very, very good. But like you, that's a very good example. Why are kids not able to be challenged and do the same thing academically? I've never really understood that either. That's a really good, really good point. And I've never really got a straight answer. I've asked that question a few times. So that's spot on. Have you figured out what the reasoning is?
I think it goes back to some of the language that's actually in some of our founding documents of our nation, is like, we believe that all men are created equal. And we feel like that we misinterpret that to mean that everybody is the same. We equate equality of worthiness with sameness. And somebody can be worthy, like somebody can be equal in the sense of human value, but not equal in the sense of talents, abilities, interests. You know, we don't expect it anywhere else. We don't expect people to be equal in their eyesight. We don't expect people to all be the same in their weight. We don't expect people to all be the same in their height. And yet somehow the idea that everybody's equal means that everybody has basically the same ability, that if we just give the right teacher, if we just pour enough money in, if we just pick the right curriculum, if we just fill in the blank, then no matter what the child's ability who shows up in the classroom, the right teacher in the right circumstance will be able to make that child into as strong of a student as a child who showed up with innate ability in that area. And that's just patently false.
Yeah. That's really interesting. You mentioned earlier about how some districts, they're not focusing on giftedness as much as they are focusing on like talent development. Talk a little bit more about that. What did you mean by that?
So there has been a big move. It's still continuing, although I have seen a mellowing out of it as districts try to lean into this programming and find it doesn't really work that well. But there was a movement that began a few years ago in the interest of equity. I think it was well-intentioned. And that was the idea that when you're testing, when you're doing identification and you're testing, that rather than using national norms where you're comparing students maybe in a very rural school district, impoverished school district, with national norms on tests, that you could end up identifying very few children. And you might identify children who tended to fall into a certain demographic. You're more likely to identify wealthy children, partly because money follows intelligence. That I could get off on that tangent. You know, I'm going to come back to that thought. I really do want to come back to that thought because I think it's something that is at the heart of this issue. But so what they would do is instead of using national norms, they would use local norms. So we would say, instead of looking for children who are in the 98th percentile nationwide or 96th percentile nationwide, we're going to look at kids who are in like the 90th percentile for our school or our school district, even if those children might be in only like the 80th percentile nationwide or even lower. And we're going to try to grow and develop those students who are scoring high for us. There is nothing wrong with that. It's a great idea, unless it also means that you're not going to recognize that there are students who are at that 96, 97, 98, 99th percentile nationwide, who then are going to have associated issues that you may be ignoring. And so local norms are great if you recognize that that doesn't mean that you get out of serving your truly, truly cognitively intelligently gifted children free card. Right? Okay. That doesn't mean you don't have to serve them, but that's how it's been used. We're going to use local norms. And that then to me is what I would call talent development. We're going to take the ability you have and we're going to try to grow that talent, as opposed to a truly gifted program, which is going to say, we're going to take the abilities you have, we're going to challenge those abilities, and we're going to support you where that super high ability causes you problems, where there's friction there in your social emotional issues, maybe even in your learning, insofar as you're going to struggle with mixed ability groups and some things like that.
Okay. So talent development to me kind of sounds like just cherry picking the best from certain areas and only focusing on those. And it's kind of like, well, obviously a student or a group of students are going to do well if that's their very strong suit. I mean, yeah, that's.
No, that's not really what I'm saying. What I'm saying is we're going to take a group of students and we're going to say that, you know, if we compare you to the rest of the country, you don't do that well. But when we compare you to, or you're just kind of average or typical, but when we compare you to other students in our school, you're doing really well. And so we're going to serve you, or in our district, you're doing really well for your peers in your school or your peers in your district. And so we're going to call that our gifted program, but really it's not truly gifted. Like, these kids do not necessarily have high IQs compared to the national norms. They do have high ability perhaps compared to other students in their area. And so, and by area, I mean geographical area. And okay. So we're going to try to grow you. We're going to try to make the most of the best that we have, rather than say, oh, well, we didn't have any kids who scored in the 98th percentile, so therefore we're not going to have a program at all.
Okay. So yeah. Okay. So we don't have kids that meet this, but we have kids that meet this, so we're going to narrow our focus. Okay, I see what you're saying.
Yeah, but the problem is, and so the reason that this arose was out of a desire to be equitable, which is a valuable and noble goal. We don't want children of color or children who are culturally or linguistically different to go underidentified, and they have for decades. Partly this is because we have, unfortunately, we have differences, unequal distribution of wealth by race and culture, right? So we have, and you can't even say it as clearly as Asian or Latino, because when you dial it down, you have children in different populations within that who are more likely to live in poverty versus more likely to be wealthy. So you, the demographics get complicated, especially if you put Asians and Pacific Islander together, right? And especially it gets complicated as we have many, many children who are not one race, who are not one culture, right? True. And when people do their DNA, they find out that almost everybody is mixed race, right? So what we have, though, is that overall, so that said, I just saying that as a caveat, overall in our country, and this is true worldwide, the dominant, the majority culture tends to have more money as immigrant populations come. Like when my ancestors who were immigrants to this country came, they were very, very poor. You know, my great grandfather from Ireland in coming in the, during the Irish potato famine, my great, great grandfather, my great grandfather coming in the Irish potato famine, they were dirt poor, like dirt poor. And then as they stayed and assimilated into American culture and got, you know, more, my grandfather didn't even graduate from high school. And then my father graduated from high school, and then I have advanced degrees. And so as that happens, then money follows that. Obviously I'm going to be more successful than my grandfather who never graduated from high school financially. And so what happens is as people get more money, then they have more education. Typically money is, household income is correlated with educational achievement. And so as I get more education, my ability to learn grows. My desire for my own children to have better education obviously appears. I have more access to money, so I have more access to cultural opportunities, educational opportunities. During the summers, my kids are going to camps and going to the library and doing things that children in poverty may not have the opportunity to do. And so as my children are exposed to those things, then they go to school and the teacher's talking about something and my kid's like, oh, I've seen that. Oh, I've been there. And so then they're able to develop neural pathways that children who haven't had those experiences don't develop. And so in education, the rich get richer in the sense of learning. So my children who go to plays and go to museums and, you know, my grandchildren now, I have grandchildren and they're going to concerts and their mom is taking them to the library all the time and they're reading and they're listening and they're having all of these experiences. That is correlated with higher achievement. And so what we find is that it's not necessarily that children of any cultural group have an innate ability that's greater. It's that if you're growing up in poverty, you're going to have fewer experiences, and over generations, that takes its toll. So equity is far more, in my mind, people would disagree with me. I need to say that. Lots of people would disagree with me. But in my mind, it's far more of a class issue than it is a race issue, because wealth is part of what builds ability. The more IQ measures how able you are to learn. And the more you learn, the more able you are to learn. Every year of education can grow your IQ. IQ is malleable, and good nutrition affects IQ. And so people who have enough money to buy quality food and their children get enough omega-3 fatty acids that build the brain, right, from protein sources that are more expensive than inexpensive foods that lack those. And so we're trying to fix inequity, inability by making sure that high ability kids who are wealthy don't get the chance, right? We're trying to make it even. And by making it even, we've made it more inequitable than it's ever been, because we're just getting rid of programs altogether. And there's nothing more inequitable than having no services whatsoever for anyone.
Well, that's interesting. Well, so then the question to that then, Lisa, is there any way to swing the pendulum back and try to even out the playing field, or are we too far the other way?
Well, I think that some of these issues are not really gifted education issues. Some of these are very large societal issues that if anybody's going to solve them, it's going to be gifted kids who are taught well, but they're very difficult to solve. You know, poverty is complicated. 2 years ago, I decided to spend an entire year doing a deep dive into learning about poverty and reading about poverty and how to solve it and what possible solutions are. And I kind of came to the conclusion myself, and again, many people disagree with me, that it's not really solvable. Like there are things we could do to make it better, but it's not really solvable as a whole because there are just too many conflating factors. And once you start teasing it apart, it just gets more and more complicated. It's one of those things that the more you learn, the more complicated it gets. And so, but I think that, so that big, huge issue aside, even if we can't solve that, or at least we can't solve it with the tools we have right now, then what we can do is perhaps offer talent development programs alongside gifted programs so that we don't turn anyone away. I love the idea of local norms to have a talent development program, but simultaneously, I want to see gifted students served. And I think we should worry less. And I think we should make sure that our identification instruments are as fair as they can possibly be, and that we should iterate them in order to be more fair as better and better instruments come forth. But that we shouldn't say, oh, you know what? The demographics of our truly gifted program don't actually match the demographics of our school district. Therefore, we should get rid of the program. It's inherently unfair. I think that's very, very short-sighted, and it ignores what we know. So I live in Texas, and we have a large immigrant population from Latin American countries, to a lesser extent, Africa and Asia. And, you know, when students come to the United States and they don't speak English as their first language and they are learning English, even if they have high ability, it's going to be masked by the language difficulty. And I've experienced this the other way. I've moved to Germany when my children were school age. And while they were gifted in the United States and identified for gifted programs in the United States, when we got to Germany and they can't read or speak German at all, obviously they're not going to qualify for gifted programs there. And so we have to recognize that we need to give kids a little bit of time to learn the language and then keep going. But also think about that people who are willing to move to another country for better opportunity, you don't see a lot of, you know, professors and doctors and accountants who are leaving where they live, unless they're seeking asylum. They don't typically leave where they are. Successful people tend to stay where they're successful. And so what we have is that it's okay. Also, giftedness isn't elitist. It's not aspirational. There's no moral value in being gifted. And we need to normalize the fact that it's okay if you have average intelligence, and we don't do that. And so we say, oh, well, you know, if you work as whatever profession you want to say that we don't really think is that valuable, even though it is, all professions are needed. Every job is necessary to make our society work. But if we say, oh, well, it's not okay to be a janitor. You know, you should want to have a college degree and you should want to do this. You know, my piano tuner is in Mensa. There's no moral value to jobs. And so, I mean, some jobs have immoral value, obviously, you're like a mafia boss, but there's nothing inherently more moral or of more value than inherent value to being the teacher than to being the janitor who cleans that teacher's classroom in school. And so I think part of the key to this is valuing people equally and stop pushing the idea that college education is the end all be all. And that, you know, that there's some kind of moral superiority to going to college. So all of these issues in gifted identification are so complicated because they're so tied up in how we view ourselves, how we value stuff. I object so strongly to kindergartners going to school where their teacher's like college banner is outside, like the pennant is outside their classroom. That is so ridiculous because first of all, if you're 5 years old, that to think about that you're supposed to be motivated by something that's not going to happen in your life for 13 years is absolutely ridiculous. That's like trying to motivate me to by telling me something I should aspire to that's not going to happen for 200 years. It's so ridiculous. But the other thing that's ridiculous is sending this message that college is the goal of elementary and secondary education, that there's no other goal besides tertiary education. That's just ridiculous. You know, we have so many other goals and so many other values taught in elementary and secondary education. And I feel like that emphasis on collegism is really problematic. And I think it goes along with that elitism that we see in gifted ed. It's perfectly fine for gifted ed students to want to be welders and piano tutors and automotive mechanics and aircraft mechanics. Like you can do whatever you want. Just because you're gifted doesn't mean that you owe the world a PhD.
That's a really good point. In my high school, there's one of my buddies, he graduated top 10 and he had decided not to go to college. And there were legions of teachers that kept asking the same question. Why, you know, why not? Why don't you want to go to college? He's like, I don't really want to. And B, I don't feel like having a student debt when I'm done. He chose a electrician. Now he wanted to be an electrician and he's highly successful right now. So I agree 1,000%, Lisa, what you're saying.
Well, we've all paid a plumber on Sunday.
Yep. I'm not a handyman at all. I wish I was, because that, you know, that vocation is very highly sought after right now. But yeah, I agree 100%. There's no, I think there's definitely an inherent value to going to college, but it's definitely not one of those things that has to happen. And like you said, it's not, there should be no value attached to it. And like you said too, just because, you know, kindergartner, elementary school, or even like you said, secondary, intermediate school, just because those kids see, you know, college banners in a room shouldn't behoove them to automatically click and say, by golly, I have to go to college because my teacher did. No, it doesn't or it shouldn't work that way.
I agree. And there are so many different paths, and there's paths open to all students. You don't have to be a genius to go to college. And you don't have to go to college if you are a genius. Like, there's no correlation. Now, I love college. All of my student, all of my children, my personal children, all of them have college degrees. I collect college degrees. and so I'm not opposed to college, but I don't think the message is that if you are smart, therefore, like this ipso facto, that you must go to college. And I feel like that idea, that message is tied into and intricately woven into this elitist idea of gifted ed, right? Because we push college so much in gifted ed, then that adds to this idea that it's so inequitable. And I feel like if more people believed and understood that it's perfectly fine for gifted students to do all kinds of jobs and didn't push college so much, then we would be more likely to meet their needs in other levels of education.
Yeah, that's a very good point. So Lisa, in terms of equability, you know, making things even for everybody, do you think like universal testing for giftedness is the right way to go?
I think universal screening is an excellent first step. So if I were a district, and I just did some consulting with a district recently who's trying to iterate their identification process and policies. And one of the things that I talked about was the importance of having a very robust website where all of your policies and procedures are extremely transparent, where all of the offerings that you have are listed, where teachers, where parents can look by school to see what services are offered at different schools within the districts and what they can expect. I think that for identification procedures, that needs to be very clear. How do we do that? Allowing nominations. I'm in total agreement with NAGC about allowing nominations from the students themselves, from even from peers, from parents, from teachers, from administrators. I think a lot of times we expect nominations to come solely from classroom teachers, and especially in core content areas. But, you know, my daughter-in-law's sister is an elementary school PE teacher. And I think that she, like PE teachers, music teachers, art teachers, they see a different side of kids than what gets presented in the core content areas in a way that can lead, like when you're explain, when a PE teacher or coach is explaining to students, like a certain way to play the game, certain rules, they can tell, they've explained those rules hundreds of times to hundreds of kids. And when one kid says, oh, so that means if you do this, this, they're like, oh, wow, okay, that's not a connection that a lot of kids make. Those teachers need to be invited and encouraged to make referrals as well, because they see the kids in a different venue where a child may feel shy or insecure in a classroom, but they may come out, especially those kids who are linguistically different, right? Learning English, they may see some abilities that other people don't see. So encouraging nominations from a wide range of people and stakeholders. Also allowing for some subjective measures. So inventories, portfolios of work. Some of these things are underutilized. And I also think that we need to make sure that we are having an array of instruments that we use. So rather than saying, oh, our district only uses COGAT, don't do that, because then your very wealthiest parents are going to pay for COGAT prep. And then that's going to make it uneven and unequal. So say we use, you know, a wide array of instruments, including these, and list 4 or 5 that you use. And then you do obviously have to use those. But don't just marry yourself to one objective instrument. You want more than one listed, because they're not going to be able to, probably very few people would be able to do a ton of like test prep on 5 different instruments.
I think that's an awesome idea, Lisa, how let's see the entire person, not just, not just the regular core teachers, but the PE teachers, the world language teachers, the music teachers. Let's invite everybody else to the room and just see, let's see the full aspect of the student. I think that's an awesome idea.
Well, you mentioned world language, and I hadn't mentioned that, and I completely agree. Like, if you have a teacher who's teaching world language, and they're teaching a student who, like, let's say they're a Spanish teacher, and they're teaching the subjunctive tense, which we kind of have in English. We have a subjunctive voice. It's the fiddler on the roof, if I were a rich man, that's the subjunctive. But in Spanish, it's a full tense, and it's fairly complex for English learners, like people learning Spanish learners who are native English speakers. And if you have a teacher who's like trying to teach this subjunctive tense, and you have a student who gets it right away, and then you notice that they also got the preterite right away, and they got the imperfect right away, and they're using the language and they're playing with the language, like that's something that might not show up in the regular language arts classroom, where there's been a disfocus, a diminishment in focus on grammar. And so they might be showing language ability in a different way than what we were expecting. And so when we get the whole faculty on board as basically talent scouts, right? Like instead of the core content teachers being gatekeepers, then you're really going to have more equity in your gifted program.
I think that's outstanding. Refer to teachers as talent scouts, and make sure you keep your ears and eyes peeled for, you know, for everybody. I think that's awesome. Wow. That's really cool, Lisa. I don't want to take any more of your time, Lisa. I just want to bring up quickly, you are going to be, you're scheduled to be a speaker at the upcoming conference this fall. If you want to hit on that a little bit, you can. Are you looking forward to coming to the Dells in October?
I'm so excited. So I've been there once before. I've keynoted the conference once before, and I was so honored and thrilled to be invited back. I love Wisconsin so much, and I love Wisconsin for three reasons. Besides its natural beauty, last time I came to the conference, I visited my friend in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, where I used to live, and I drove from Cedar Rapids up to the Dells, and I can still remember it because, you know, it's fall, it was October as well, and just the harvest was going on, and as I drove through the farms and fields, I just felt like this is America. My German ancestors actually settled in Wisconsin and Minnesota when they immigrated from Germany. And so I feel lots of connection there. Additionally, I have a very good friend who lives in Eau Claire, Wisconsin. And my sister actually lives in Wisconsin. And for this trip in October, I told my siblings that I was going to be there. And so my other two siblings who live in Washington State are going to fly out, and after the conference, the four of us are going to get together and have a sibling retreat. Our dad is struggling with pancreatic cancer right now and in treatment, and we've all been, you know, stressed by that, and he had open heart surgery earlier this year, and so the four of us are going to take a sibling retreat in beautiful Wisconsin in October. Additionally, I'm super excited because Wisconsin is a state where it has consistently leaned into gifted ed, and your state organization is a shining star. And so I just love coming to see your teachers who are wonderful and your organization, which is wonderful. And I am very, very, very much looking forward to it. It's a week after my birthday, and I'm more excited about the conference than I could ever be about my birthday. So really looking forward to it.
Well, we are definitely looking forward to having you, Lisa. Really sorry to hear the news about your dad. Hopefully everything is okay with that. And really, you're probably looking forward to the retreat as well. It should be a yes. Really good time. The fall is my favorite time of year in Wisconsin. So
thank you for your well wishes. And yes, I'm very much looking forward to it. I'm very grateful for the opportunity to be on this podcast. And I really appreciate, Corey, how you allow me to kind of explain at length about some of these things, because lots of times people don't necessarily want to read the whole length of it. And so it's so nice to be able to talk it through, and people can listen to the podcast at, you know, 1.5 speed if they want to and just hear. And it can be difficult, and it's kind of a risk. I'm trusting your listening audience a lot, because I'm trusting them to hear what I'm saying, and it can sound problematic. We don't like to believe that because you don't have a lot of money that might diminish your educational opportunities. But I grew up in poverty, and I can remember when I was a child, we had $7 a week for food. I knew it. I mean, I knew that we had that much, and I knew how hard it was for my mom to put food on the table. We lived in a tiny apartment, and my mom would like grow artichokes on the balcony for us to eat. And frequently dinner was an artichoke that my mom and I would share. And So I grew up poor. And I know that when I was little, it did influence it. You know, it did influence what I had access to. Now, my mother had also grown up poor, but she was intelligent and she sought it. But it was only as I got older and she had, you know, she was a single mom, and as she had more time and as I was able to do more things, that I was able to display and start making connections in these areas. And so I wasn't identified for the gifted program until fifth grade. And I think a lot of that, the reason I wasn't identified earlier, had to do with the poverty in which I lived. And so I don't say these things in a way that is snobbish or arrogant. It's not only from my reading, but from personal experience, and that poverty has a deleterious effect on our students' ability to access their ability.
Wow, that's amazing. And I think that's that resonates a lot more, Lisa, because you've lived it. And I think that should really hit home for a lot of people. And I think that's really a strong message. And thank you for sharing that. So I think that's really, really impactful. So, once again, Lisa, thanks a lot for coming on the Waytag podcast. I sincerely appreciate it. You've been absolutely amazing. And we look forward to having you as a keynote speaker for the Waytag conference in October at Wisconsin Dells at the Wilderness. So it should be amazing as well there too.
I'm so sorry to interrupt. Thank you so much, Corey. Thank you for having me as a guest, and thank you to all of the listeners. And if you did hear this podcast, please come up and talk to me at the conference and say that you did, and we can have a little bonding moment. So looking forward to seeing everybody, and thank you again so much for the opportunity.